Hi, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. It is January 2nd, 2020. So I hope your New Year's was a safe one. And wherever you're at emotionally, psychologically right now, we welcome you to the broadcast. So tonight is an open forum. It's for siblings. It's about siblings, if you want it to be. It's for extended family and friends. If you have a question that you're getting asked by one of your family or friends or from the sibling of a child left at home in this evoke process, you can ask that question as if it's from them. If you are a sibling, or even if you're asking for and in behalf of a sibling, please let me know the age of the person asking the question or the question that's being asked for them. Let me know their age, because that helps me think about my answer in a way that I'll speak to that age, what fits, I think, for that age. So again, any question you have about siblings, for siblings, from siblings, extended family and friends, anything you're having a difficult time responding to or explaining to other people, feel free to submit that question at any point. Lindsay, who's moderating for me this evening, will then pass on those questions to me. I'm going to start with a couple of pre-submitted questions and then some quotes before we get to any of your live questions. This actually isn't a quote, but somebody just sent it to me today, a picture, a cartoon. For those of you who are listening on the podcast, it's kind of the reverse order of the thing we see about evolution, where it starts off with modern human Homo sapiens and kind of digresses back into primitive animals and eventually a fish into the sea. The reason I thought this was funny and it caught my eye was I think it's a nice vivid illustration of regression. So many times we think about, we have experiences with our family of origin or going back to an earlier context, and we find ourselves regressing. I know for me and my wife, it was interesting in our early years of marriage to watch that happen to each other, to watch how my child responded to her parents, for her to watch how I responded to my siblings and parents, and almost to step back and say, you know, this is not the you that I know. But what I know about that now is those old relationships can be regressive, right? There's a certain context that we tend to regress back into a primitive way of coping and of responding. I've shared that quote from Ram Dass lately, where he says, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a week with your family. It's this idea. And part of why I share that tonight, or start off with that image, that idea, is just especially around the holidays, especially around the family, no matter what the occasion, be kind to yourself and understand that it's a natural way to respond to old relationships. And that, it doesn't mean we have to stay there, but be kind to yourself if you find yourself feeling in old ways and responding and behaving in old ways. Somebody asked me this question via email the last couple of days. Somebody asked the question, why do you teach I feel statements, but then hesitate to suggest that parents share their feelings with their children? This is a very, very fair question. And I'm going to try to take a moment to kind of outline my thinking around this. There is value in knowing what you feel. There's value in even expressing what you feel. I love this quote that I saw recently that says, you don't have to tell everything to everybody, but you have to tell everything to somebody, right? That the idea that we're only as sick as our secrets. It's an idea that is shared both in the recovery community, that is the treatment industry and philosophy for addiction, and also in the therapeutic community, that idea of talking to a safe container, a safe person, a safe space is fundamentally important to healing. Finding somebody that can hear you, resonate with you, and understand your perspective is important. So that skill can be important. I think the I feel statement is as much a meditative practice as it is an interpersonal practice. That is this. I remember I had one student client, young adult, actually told me some time ago, he said, I don't see the value in this. I'm not going to say this. I'm not going to use this skill with my parents when I go home and I leave here. And I said, that's okay. It doesn't have to be for that purpose. But it's a practice of understanding what you feel, what you think, what's inside and outside of your control. What's the generating thought, the thought that's coming beneath that causes the feeling. And so we know about silent meditation. We know about, many of us know even about an eating or a walking meditation or a mindfulness practice. I think that the I feel statement is a talking meditation, right? It's taking stock of what we think, feel, believe, what our interpretations are, what we're hoping for that's inside of our control and hoping for that's outside of our control. So it has its value. I think the reason that I talk so hesitantly is because it is innate. And almost everybody I teach and talk to that wonders about the I feel statement as a tool for changing somebody else. I remember years ago being in a parent support group in Los Angeles, California, where a mother shared with pride, like she was proud of herself, was sharing feelings. She told us a story where she shared feelings that she had shared with her son recently, her adult son, who at first said that he would help her move, and then he backed out of it. And then when she shared her feelings, he accused her of trying to guilt trip him. And her response was, "I'm not trying to guilt trip you. I'm just telling you how I feel." And most people in the support group applauded her. Right? They saw this as a victory. I've heard clients in the field, young people in the field, encouraged by peers and encouraged by the staff and even therapists sometimes, in asking getting asked the question, "Have you told your parents how they feel, how you feel about this?" And I think under all of this, there is this idea that's difficult to escape, where if I tell you how I feel, you then become responsible for changing so that I feel differently. And yet the I feel statement is, the goal or objective of the I feel statement is exactly the opposite. The goal or objective of the I feel statement is ownership. I feel this way. I feel this way. I used to tell this story from a graduate school experience with my favorite professor. She was wonderful, made a huge impact in my life and my relationships and my career. And she had one flaw that I saw, and that was she was always late. And on Monday night, we had a 2.5 hour long practicum experience. We would practice therapy. Sometimes we would watch somebody do therapy on video or live through a one-way mirror. And we would then process it as a group. And it was the class that I looked forward to, number one, because she was my favorite professor, and number two, because I learned so much from that experience. It was such a rich experience. So she was late again. In fact, this particular evening, she was 20 or 30 minutes late. And the small group of us, there were 6 or 7 of us in the class, we kind of informally elected me to give her an I feel statement, a version of an I feel statement when she got to class late. So she walked in and I shared with her how I felt, that I was frustrated at her being late, and told her that I felt this way because I looked so forward to this class and we paid for this class and it was just difficult. And she said to me with gentleness and love and kindness, she said, "That makes total sense. I can see where you would be frustrated." And she stopped there. And I remember thinking, probably like a lot of you might be thinking right now, well, that's not enough. That's kind of copping out, really. But something started to take root in me. I realized it is my feeling. And I could do something about it. I could drop the class. I could complain to the dean or to the university. And I think if I had done anything like that, my professor would have supported me. She wouldn't have punished me for it. And she would have understood, and she would have dealt with the consequences, whatever they were, on her side of things. But the fact that she just listened underscored the idea that it was mine. And then it was mine to deal with. And it also underscored my expectation that I expected her to do something different as a result of my sharing the I feel statement. And in couples therapy, in parental parent-child therapy, family therapy, all versions of therapy, I cannot overstate how common it is that we think that that's what the purpose of the I feel statement is. So we don't throw away the I feel statement. We still use it, but it's important that all of us, and I want to point this out, even therapists stumble into the idea that the I feel statement is for changing other people. It's implied. It's just included in the overall process. So I'm telling you because that's not what it's for. And I hesitate more with parents than other dyads because you operate as a parent a different place in your child's mind than anybody else. Parents are different creatures to children, right? I was talking to a client today and the point was made, even though she's well into adulthood, right? Into her mid-30s, and she was talking about this idea that her parents are always her parents, right? They always occupy that same role. So I don't want to throw away the I feel statement because it has value. In fact, the very fact that I get asked this question gives me an opportunity to teach a fundamental aspect of the parent-child relationship and dynamic. Now, I found I'm going to go through part of tonight's broadcast. I'm going to share with you some quotes. And here's a quote from somebody I follow on Instagram called The Holistic Psychologist. And she says this, "The stubborn or difficult child is the frustrated child who was never meant to meet the needs of a parent." And I reshared this on my own page today. The point being that there is, I tell this to our therapists all the time, this is essentially what we're treating almost all the time. And young therapists or new therapists always look at me like I'm exaggerating. Like, I'm sure it happens in severe cases and exaggerated cases, but it's not a mainstream dynamic. And I patiently try to tell them it is, it's just not visible. We really, in our culture, and not just our culture, because I deal with cultures in other countries, this is an idea that kind of seeps into the parent-child dynamic. It is not the child's job to take care of the parent. And when the child is unconsciously enlisted in that obligation, he or she suffers. When the parent develops the capacity, which I would define as love, when the parent develops the capacity to love the child, the parent welcomes the child's feelings, whatever they are, especially if they're angry, frustrated, or hurt feelings toward the parent. The parent is not compromised by that. They don't necessarily capitulate, change their behavior, but they welcome it and they know it. My therapist taught me years ago, she said, rebellion is kind of a last resort. Martin Luther King Jr. said that violence is the language of the unheard. It's all the same idea. The acting out behavior is trying to tell us something. It's trying to tell us something is not working. And it can't be reduced to a child's being entitled or a child just doesn't want to cooperate. That's not what it's about. That's what we frame it as, so that the child now is the problem, right? We talk about a child's upset feelings in ways that make them the problem. I was talking with a client recently about this idea that children, in the work that I do, children often gravitate toward the lowest common denominator of society, right? They find themselves in relationships where there are no expectations. There's no bar that has to be met. And they end up behaving in ways that are dangerous and self-destructive in these contexts, in these relationships. And that's true. And what I try to teach parents and talk about is what attracts them to those people. It is the little that is expected of them to be accepted. Now, it's not completely true because there still are some requirements for membership, if you will, but that's the draw. And so our work as parents in the world, it's not about Evoke therapy programs. It's not about if your child is in treatment, because there are a lot of people that listen to this broadcast via the podcast app who don't have children in our program or in any program. But the role is to develop enough resources to support your child. To have boundaries, of course. First and foremost, to have boundaries, actually. But to constantly develop your capacity to be there for the child in the ways that the child needs. instead of flipping it and have it be that the child shows up for the way that you need for them to show up. But here's the insidious part of it, folks. This is the part that is difficult. You know what prevents us from developing greater capacity to be there for our children? Guilt. It is that we don't set boundaries out of guilt. We don't set boundaries, which is really just self-care, because we feel guilty. We feel like a failure. And so we starve ourselves psychologically and spiritually, emotionally, and then we show up to the relationship with the child and we have nothing to give. And we try to shape them up in the ways that we need. That's the psychology of all this that we talk about all the time. That's why my new book talks about first, it'll be out in January, later this month, my new book talks about at first the idea that we need to develop a sense of self first. We need to unwind and heal and unpack the wounds of our own childhood. We need to do battle with guilt and shame. You know, walk past those guards that tell us that we shouldn't be doing something or other, and fill ourselves up so that we can be there for our loved ones. I have a couple of other questions that have come in this week. Somebody asked the question that wasn't quite clear. How can I support the sibling left at home? And I think there are two issues around supporting the sibling at home, and I'll separate them into these categories. First of all, the sibling who's still angry at their sibling. I don't want to write. I don't want anything to do with them. I don't want to hear how they're doing. Those kinds of feelings and responses to this dynamic. And the first thing I would say is honor it. Honor it. Children that have been mistreated or abused by the sibling that got sent to evoke, or even maybe just created a context, an environment that was chaotic and conflictual. That's a kind of an abuse. Those children that are left at home, for the first time in their life, they're trying to take back control, because a key ingredient in all trauma is the lack of control over it. That's important. And so when we insert our agenda as parents or loved ones, and even justify it by our what we call our good intentions, we're still abusing the sibling left at home. We're still trying to take away their agency, their freedom, and get them to do what we think is the right thing to do on our time frame because of our agenda. And I'm not even disagreeing with your impulse. Your impulse is that you want the people in your family to love each other. There could be nothing negative about that. But when it gets implemented in these situations, it's what I heard a therapist call one time, good abuse. And there's no way that good abuse can solve bad abuse. So you honor it. You give them the space. You take yourself out of the relationship between the two siblings. I know for myself, I was a typical older brother to my younger brother. I bullied him. He was 2.5 years younger. I didn't like him hanging around me. I wasn't nice to him. I didn't like that he copied me. And he was smaller than me, and so when you feel powerless, you kick the weakest one in the family. So I did the things that older brothers did to their younger brothers. When I grew up and became an adult, I wanted him to forgive me because I was a child and I didn't mean it, and I wasn't abnormal. So what's the big deal? And it took me almost a decade to realize that this wasn't going to happen on my terms. And that he would be allowed to forgive me or not on his terms. And he's my best friend in the world now for the past 20, 25 years. My best friend, my favorite person to be around. And part of that came only after I stopped trying to force my apology on him and get him to forgive me. So it's relatable. The second category of siblings left at home is the one who's angry at the parent for sending the child away. You won't be surprised to know that it's the same answer as the first category, which is honor the feelings. Let them have it. I mean, part of the work that we have to do as parents, if we're to do this work, is we have to find a source for our own self-esteem so that we don't require and ask for it from our children. We have to be okay enough with ourselves that we allow our children to be angry with us. That doesn't mean you need to tolerate abuse or any kind of language. I mean, you get to decide what that limit is. And there are days when you can handle more than other days, days when your bandwidth is taxed and days when your bandwidth is more generous. But fundamentally, it is our task as parents to develop enough of a sense of self, enough of a sense of okayness, so that we don't require our children to like us, to love us, to sign off on our choices toward them or toward their siblings, right? So it's the same answer. Learn, and just learning to, and I'll repeat the phrase, honor the defense, okay? Because both of these are defenses. And defenses, what are defenses? Defenses are protective mechanisms that people put in place to protect them from hurt and pain. So when we honor the defense instead of attacking it or trying to tear it down, the defense shrinks just a little bit. But if we attack the defense or try to tear it down, the defense is usually reinforced, strengthened, more solidified. All right, I have a few more quotes that I posted lately that I'll talk about. This is one where I say that Joseph Campbell, the philosopher, the scholar that studied myths that the heroic journey is based on. Joseph Campbell taught that every religion is true in one way or another. And then I had this thought. When children speak, they're always telling the truth in one way or another, even if they're lying. The trick is to develop the ears to hear what they are trying to tell us. Right? The defense is doing important work. The defense is there to distract everybody from the hurt. And so part of the work, I think this is essentially the invitation or the journey of my first book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is the message is you develop new ears and eyes to hear and see with. That's the goal. So that when your child is acting out, you hear what they're trying to tell you. It doesn't mean that your boundaries have to be compromised. I almost have to say that every time because people, it's hard for people to develop or experience empathy without feeling that they need to then compromise their boundaries. But you can have your boundaries. I'm not talking about changing your boundaries. I'm talking about the relationship you have with your child and their issues. The other quote that I shared that I'm talking about right now says, regarding mental health, remember the defense or the symptom is doing important work. If it were not so, it wouldn't require so much energy. And if we focus on the symptom, even with the desire to eradicate it, it has done its job. The symptom serves to distract from the authentic wound. So part of being trained in this work, part of being trained as a therapist, is to see behaviors, maladaptive behaviors, for what they are, which is a defense or a distraction from a more authentic suffering, as Carl Jung would put it. The narcissistic wound. I know the word narcissism, the term, the diagnosis narcissism, is a dirty word that we throw around at people to insult wounded people. And the reason we do it with narcissism specifically is because narcissism makes us, it hurts us, right? And the narcissist is condescending and arrogant, and the natural impulse to a narcissist is to try to tear them down to size. That's part of why it works. The defense works because it gets us engaged in this other battle. But the narcissistic wound for any of us is the wound of not being seen. Okay? And we all have some of that. Some of us more than others, and some of us develop different ways of coping with that lack of parental resonance, that lack of that fractured attachment. So everybody has some bit of a narcissistic wound. And if it develops into full-fledged narcissism, that becomes its diagnosis. But don't fantasize that all of us don't have some of this. And there's this thought that I've been writing about and thinking about lately that says, if you don't learn to carry around your own horrible, rotten self, your children will feel the need to do it for you. And they will at the cost of their authentic selves. Or they won't and suffer great guilt for failing you, for failing the task. This means not buying into the myth that the badness is out there, outside of us. So we have to learn to be okay with being wrong, bad. And because all of us are narcissistically wounded, we spend so much of our time in every relationship, including, sadly, the relationship with our children, trying to prove that we're good. And that hurts everybody, and it hurts children most. Because if I need to be good, then guess who's going to be bad? The child. If the child and I are in conflict and I need to be good, I will make the child bad. And I've done this more than I would like to admit. So what is the task? The task is going back and healing the narcissistic wound. And there's another way to describe this. If you could imagine, this is a thought experiment. If you could imagine the ideal that you knew you were okay. I love the word okay because it's not good, not in contrast to bad. It's just you're okay. If you knew that you were okay in all your relationships, maybe specifically in the parent-child relationship, guess what kind of tolerance and acceptance you would have for your child's anger, sadness, and frustration with you? You would have tremendous tolerance. In fact, you would respond in the ideal way of parenting, which is to say to a child, thank you for telling me. I'm glad you're talking about it. It makes sense. Keep talking, keep telling me, right? That's the antidote. That's the antidote to acting out behaviors. It's the only thing you can do. So if you don't carry around and learn to come to terms with and become friends with your own horrible, rotten self, that's just a funny way of saying your own humanness, your own fallibility, your own imperfectness, you know, the yin and the yang, the good and the bad and how it's all mixed together. If you don't make peace with that, you will make the people in your life the villain. You will buy into the notion that the problem is out there. Again, just because I can hear from my past discussions with people about this, the response, but what does that mean I have to allow for abuse? Absolutely not. But when you do this, it doesn't feel like abuse anymore because it doesn't feel like it's about you. And of course, if you get exhausted in a certain situation, relationship, discussion, you're allowed to take care of yourself, right? And hang up the phone. Take care of yourself and take a time out. In extraordinary cases, get a divorce. Leave somebody who's abusing you. You're allowed to do any of that, anytime that you want. But with all of those steps towards self-care, you'll have to deal with guilt. Because you will think, and they will tell you, that you're being a selfish jerk, that you're abandoning them, that you're being too sensitive, that you're overreacting, that you're being ridiculous. But if you know that you're okay, none of those things matter. It just doesn't. It doesn't even hurt. You're not repressing or ignoring it. You just see it, those insults, those things that they say as a reflection of their relationship with themselves. I like this quote. It came after a supervision session with our therapist at Evoke. The outcome of therapy is the realization that you are a disaster and a miracle, all at the same time. I was telling one of my clients recently when he was talking about, like, there'll be a certain point in therapy where he'll say to me, like, okay, here comes the really dark part of me, or here comes the real negative thought that I have. And I always say to him, fantastic. I know this is going to be great. I know we're about to get to some really deep wisdom with what you're about to share. Therapy is different than everything else, good therapy, because the task isn't to be good. And this isn't a new task. Plato, thousands of years ago, when analyzing or philosophizing, I suppose is a better word, about what laws would be present in a utopian society, came up with one law. And the law is you would just be yourself. Everybody would be themselves. But because we've been taught the notions of good and bad, we develop mental illness around it, that wound, that idea. And the greatest thinkers that have ever walked the planet Earth, they're not of the illusion that they're good. They're more comfortable with their fallibility than all of us. In fact, they talk about it quite a bit. And what do they have more than those of us who don't quite know that we're okay? They have more compassion and love and energy for everybody else in the world. So therapy's different. That's why I think it's important that everybody go to therapy, especially parents, because it's not what we were taught or shown. All right. I'm happy to take any live questions. Looks like I have a question that has come in. It says, do you have any other book suggestions for understanding the balance of valuing their authenticity and holding boundaries with their children? Well, my book that'll be out in a month speaks to that. I mean, it's the same books that I recommend often. The Dance of Anger by Harriet Lerner. It's a great book about boundaries. Really good. Really, really good. I don't love the title for what it teaches, but it teaches about taking care of yourself. I love The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller. I think it's the most important book. I love Meeting the Shadow by Zweig Abrams. It's a series of essays on the shadow side of ourself. That talks a little bit more about the idea of incorporating and becoming whole. Yeah, that's why I wrote the book, because I didn't think there was one out there that spoke, that I haven't read or come across, that spoke to it as clearly as I wanted for people. So my book, coming out in the next few weeks, and I'll of course advertise that and talk about it and during the launch, but it speaks to this idea that I'm talking about tonight. I'm happy to take any other questions before I go on to announcements. This is from a 9-year-old. Do I ever have to talk to my sister again? Guess you don't have to. No? If you don't want to, you don't have to. Your parents might require that you not be cruel or unkind, but you don't have to. At least not in our house. I guess your parents get to decide in your house, but in my house, I wouldn't try to force a 9-year-old to talk to somebody in the family that had hurt him or her. That wouldn't be my inclination, my instinct. All right, I'm going to go through upcoming events, and then if you have any questions, I'll answer those. At the end again, we ask all current parents to come to a parent workshop. The next one is in Utah, is January 25th and 26th, and in February in Oregon is February 16th, 15th and 16th. We ask all current families to go to this. It's great psychoeducation. Talk to your child's therapist and ask them if a visit to the field matches up well with that timing. I'll be in New York City on Monday, January 27th at 7 p.m. And we'll, like I said, earlier this week, we'll try to get a list of parent support groups across the country listed here. I have some new intensives on here. The January 8th through 12th is full. The next opening we have is in February, February 19th through 23rd. I will also be in England. That's about an hour and a half outside of London on May 8th through 10th. So if you know anybody, if you happen to be from the UK, you don't have to come across the ocean all the way to Utah to do one of these. We ran one earlier, or last year, I should say, in the same location, and it was beautiful and wonderful and a joy to do it over there. If you have been to a Finding U2, we have the dates for the next Finding U2s. April 16th through 19th and July 15th through 19th are what we're shooting for. We need enough participants for those, so contact intensives at evoketherapy.com and let us know of your interest. Many former groups want to come back with people that they know. So if you know somebody, if you've been to a Finding U and you want to come back with that group, oftentimes the groups stay in touch for years afterwards. Let them know the dates, April 16th through 19th and July 15th through 19th for Finding U2. The only requirement is that you have been through a Finding U in the first place. You can go to our website for information on customized intensives for couples, families, and professionals and individuals, or just email us at intensives@evoketherapy.com. Pursuits trips are adventure-based trips that are therapy light, anywhere from a few days to a month, anywhere in the world. Virtually any adventure activity in the world, think therapy light or sober fun for an individual or a family. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous. Adultchildren.org is a great place. ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, is a great place to go if you think you had a family that may have been especially toxic. I think it's great for anybody. Alateen is for teens. Refuge Recovery. At refugerecovery.org is a Buddhist-inspired recovery program for people that might enjoy more a recovery program that's not as central, it's not as based on higher power, that idea. The National Alliance on Mental Illness has a website at NAMI.org, N-A-M-I.org, for those of you who, if you want a free class or resources in your area, your local area, contact them and they can let you know what's available there. All of these broadcasts are available on the podcast app on an iPhone or an iOS device using the podcast app, on an Android device using the SoundCloud app, or on your computer, go to soundcloud.com. Just search Evoke Therapy Programs there. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find Evoke Therapy Programs using the handle @EvokeTherapy. You can also find the intensive program on Instagram using the handle @EvokeSummitLodge. On Facebook, find us by searching searching Evoke Therapy Programs or the Alumni Foundation that helps raise money for people who can't afford therapy by searching Evoke Family Foundation. And of course, our blog is available on our website with upcoming information. My book is available on Amazon, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. Also, any book that you buy on the Parent Alumni Foundation can, if you buy it there through the Amazon Smiles program, a percentage of the proceeds goes to help people who can't afford therapy. Somebody asks, what if one parent is not healthy, for example, an active alcoholic? Well, you're going to have a disadvantage. That's the simplest answer. It's going to be like fighting a fight with one hand tied behind your back. And there are two things that I will say about this. Number one, don't become obsessed with them. It is easy for us in our codependency to become obsessed with the obvious and harmful behavior of our co-parent. So you need support and recovery, so you stay on your side of the street. That's the simple answer. And it's so easy to become your problem. That's the first thing. The second thing is even better news. The research says that if we have one parent that truly sees us, it makes a dramatic and fundamental difference in our lives, in our adulthood. If somebody sees us as a child during our childhood and is consistent and there for us, it makes a difference. Two is ideal, one is enough. One is enough. So you can still make a difference, but you're gonna have different disadvantages and there's gonna be trauma. But the biggest pitfall is to become obsessed with, focused on changing the co-parent. There's a great, well, I don't know if it's great, but there's a podcast webinar that I've done on this called Co-Parenting that you can look at that talks about this question at length, in greater length. It's a next question that comes in. In the past, my son very often said I was guilt tripping when I suggested ask him to do follow up on things or do things. I felt most of the time he was using this to get out of having to follow through. But is it possible I was always guilt tripping since this is what he felt, even if I did not intend it? Possibly. That, by the way, just so you know, is a fantastic question, a courageous question. Chances are, maybe you were. It really has taken me, I'm going to use a word that's not going to sound very great, decades to become clear about how much it happens. I had a client recently tell me, he said, after being around his family for the holidays, he told me, he said, it's everywhere. There's so much pressure from adults on children about the way to be. And you're right. There's a possibility that it was about just him wanting to get out of it. But let me tell you this. In the long run, when or as your boundaries get more and more clear, you become comfortable with yourself and assert your boundaries, you'll talk less to your children about what ought to be and about what they are and aren't doing. And when my client was telling me this experience about being around his family, whom, by the way, he loves dearly, and who, by all accounts I can tell, are great people. But he said to me, Brad, it's everywhere. Everywhere I look. And that's the experience for most of us. So I love your question, because I think it's so courageous to consider that. But after a while, you do this work, you'll know. You'll know that you're doing it more than you thought. You'll know that they were right. And you'll know when it's being used inappropriately. And you won't argue or try to make your point. You won't try to get them to feel or think anything. You'll just simply have boundaries and they'll have to adjust. And you won't have strong opinions about them. That's the amazing thing. You won't have... The longer I do this work, the less opinions I have about other people. I'm not perfect and completely enlightened in that way, but that's the progress. I have fewer opinions about other people, including my children. But I have more clear ideas about myself and what I need and what I will tolerate and won't tolerate, what I'm okay and not okay with. So yeah, great question. Really evidence of a high level of courage, of what I would call heroic parenting, right? And for those of you that are listening to this broadcast on the podcast, that's what this is. That's what the work that I do, that we do is. It's compassionately, lovingly inviting us into an inward journey where we begin to discover things that we were not aware of and didn't see. Things that we were never taught, were never modeled for us. All of those things. So thank you for that wonderful, wonderful question. And your child is lucky to have a parent who's willing to ask a question like that. All right, the next broadcast, right in line with what I'm talking about, is I'm going to talk in detail about therapy at home. Why intending therapy and what kind of work, how to get a good therapist, how to engage them in a way that supports the work that we're doing here with your child. So I'm going to talk about home therapy and attending support groups, and the value and the task involved and what your work is. So thank you. Thank you so much for your participation. Thank you for, on behalf of your children, thank you for your willingness to attend, to listen. Whoever is in your life, I thank you for them, because this is not an education in manipulation about how to change everybody around you. Of course, the change you make will have a ripple effect. But this is a much more courageous and brave endeavor. This is going into the places that we were told to fear. This is going into the places that our parents were told to fear. So thank you for attending. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being willing to do this work. I will talk to you this Monday, January 6th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. And the topic is, why are home therapy and attending a support group valuable for all of you? Thanks, folks. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you Monday. Take care. Bye-bye.